Okay. All right. Good evening, everyone. Our topic for tonight is Augustine of Hippo, Saint Augustine. And we'll have to see whether or not he's an enemy of the Jews, neutral on the Jews, a friend of the Jews. Depends who you ask. So Augustine of Hippo was born in North Africa in 354. He was a witness to the vicissitudes of the power of the Roman Empire. And he saw the rift between East and West. And he was at the height of his game when the Visigoths attacked and sacked Imperial Rome in the year 410. His greatest work was titled City of God, and he wrote it as a defense against the pagan claim that Christianity had disastrously weakened Roman political and military power. Now, this is an important point, because remember what we've been saying over the last few weeks, that the church, or the church fathers, will say that the fall of Jerusalem proved what point? That Judaism has been replaced by the true religion and it's no longer has the covenant with God. Well, hey, what happened to Rome? Rome got sacked by the barbarians. Doesn't that prove that Christianity is bogus? You can make that argument, and the pagans made that argument, just like the Christians made it about Judaism. And so if you're a bishop of some significant renown in the early part of the 5th century, your only hope is to say, well, it doesn't mean that. You're reading into history incorrectly. And in fact, he will say, as we'll see shortly, that the sacking of Rome was not because the empire embraced Christianity, but rather because it had for centuries abided by a polytheistic religion worshiping the false gods of Mount Olympus and Jupiter. So that's what his dochak teretz will be, as we would say in yeshivish slang. Now, early in life, Augustine was attracted to Manichaeism, but later he converted to Catholic Christianity, to the Orthodox version of Christianity. And Manichaeism had a very hostile attitude towards the Old Testament, towards Judaism. In other words, if in the last few weeks we've been saying that Eusebius and others claim that ancient Hebrews were good, the Old Testament is virtuous, but there was a time when biological Israel had a covenantal relationship with God. It was superseded, granted, but there was a time when the Jews were important. The Manichaeans said, no, they were never good, and the Old Testament was never good. Okay, so Augustine was tempted by that, but later walked away from it. Jews do appear with frequency in his letters, and he has a tremendous impact on subsequent church perspectives on Jews and Judaism, which would survive from late antiquity all the way into the modern era. Augustine is the man. Other than the Gospels and Paul, Augustine is the key figure. And his synthesis, the Augustinian synthesis, set the parameters for Jewish life in the Christian West. What he developed was the doctrine of witness, that the Jews are a witness to what? Well, what do we, in the eyes of the church, what needs to be witnessed?
Christ.
The truths of the church. Okay. So there are 6 points.
That goes for any faith.
Correct. Any faith will emphasize that which proves the veracity of their claims, or which they will claim supports the veracity of their claims. So the doctrine of witness as it pertains to Jews will include 6 points. The first one is the survival of the Jews scattered in exile from their land and oppressed in servitude testifies to their punishment for rejecting and crucifying Jesus and to the reward of faithful Christians by contrast. So the galut, l'arba kanfo ta'aretz, to the four corners of the earth, and the fact that while in the four corners of the earth the Jews don't have it very good, that they're in a beleaguered position and are suffering, that proves that they're being punished for the rejection of Jesus. And the fact that they're suffering and the church is doing well proves the reward being given to Christians.
But didn't the church deliberately make it tough on the Jews? Yeah, that's how you're going to live because you're not becoming Christian. Therefore, we're going to make it tough
so,
on you.
So the answer to that is yes. However, that had not yet really happened when Augustine was alive. It would happen in subsequent centuries for the next, 1400 years up until, the French Revolution and the beginnings of the stirrings of the Emancipation. But in pagan Rome, up until Constantine's conversion, that's not what was going on. I mean, the Jews might have had it tough in certain instances, but it wasn't the church that was pummeling them. It would be the church that will pummel them after the Theodosian Code. So point number two, Their blindness and disbelief also fulfill biblical predictions of their repudiation and replacement, meaning that the Bible predicted that the Jews would reject Jesus. Not just that it's a bad thing and they shouldn't have rejected him, but already the Bible, the Old Testament, was anticipating that this would occur. Well, go read the Bible cover to cover and tell me where you find it. I mean, I don't know, but they found it. Point number three.
Yashka said, all you do is smile and say, I believe in God.
Okay.
So how could the Jews be so bad?
Number three. Carrying and preserving the books of the Old Testament wherever they go, they offer proof to all the people that Christians have not forged biblical prophecies concerning Jesus. Now, this is a critical point. Who's claiming that prophecies were forged? The pagans, not the Jews. Remember, the Jews are hardly relevant. The Jews are a little people, they're tucked away in the corner. Maybe they get persecuted a little bit. All right, we care about it because we're Jewish. But basically, the battle was between pagans and Christians. And the pagans will say, this is all Baba Meisa. This is all nonsense. Your theology is bunk. So what Augustine is saying here is that the survival of the physical copies of the books of the Old Testament help us prove the veracity of Christianity because we can point to really old material that predates the church or predates Jesus and point it out to the pagans that, hey, look, a really old text supports our contentions. And we wouldn't have it if not for the fact that the Jews preserved it, because after all, it was their Bible. So in a funny way, what is Augustine saying? You need the Jews, not just because you need their physical person, but you need the culture of Judaism, which is a culture of the book, which is preserving copies of the book or books that are beneficial to our propaganda arm. That's not something you necessarily would have figured, but Augustine is saying we need the Sifrei Kodesh in the hands of the Jews to prove our points. Okay, now, number four. The Jews provide such corroborating testimony not only in their books, but also in their continued compliance with biblical law. This is a controversial point. Remember, what had the church or elements of the church been saying already since the days of Paul? That you don't have to observe the mitzvahs anymore, and that mitzvah observance maybe is bad. It's a dead weight. It's a dead letter. Comes along Augustine in the year 410 or 420 and says, not only are the Jews necessary in their person and in their preservation of scrolls, but even in their continued observance of ritual law, a law that we think is irrelevant for us. But the fact that they still do it helps prove that we're right. How? Not really sure. But this is a welcome notion because it could just as easily have been the case that a church father would say, we don't want the Jews doing Judaism. We don't want them putting on tefillin every morning in talis and davening Shmon Esrei and saying Kriya Shema. They could have said, off with your head for doing such things. Instead, he said, no, it's actually helpful for us that you still do this. Augustine.
Outright, yeah.
Now, number five, the words of Psalm 59:12, quote, slay them not, lest at any time they forget your law, scatter them in your might, constitutes a prophetic policy statement on the appropriate treatment of Jews in Christendom. Slay them not. Wonderful. We're not going to get killed. So this sort of minimalist level of tolerance, we have to count our lucky stars. It would be nice if we had a First Amendment and freedom of religion and, you know, no persecution, but that'll have to wait for the Americas and for modern times. At least in late antiquity and the medieval period, Baruch Hashem, someone like Augustine says, don't kill the Jews, slay them not. A quotation from Tehillim chapter 59, verse 11. Now, what is that capital Tehillim actually talk about? The answer is, it's about David HaMelech in the days when he's on the run from Shaul, from King Saul. In the first line, the Psalm 59, verse 1, Lamanatseach al tashchet le David, mechtam b'shalach Shaul v'yashmeru et ha'bayit l'hamito, that Saul sent his goons to kill David. Fine. So verse 12, al tahargem, slay them not. Pen yishkachu ami hanimu bechelcha v'horidemu meginenu Hashem. So the real meaning of the verse is that David is praying, don't eliminate Saul's goons all at once, right now, when I'm on the run in some cave somewhere, and they might just plot some heart attack. Because after all, they're just a bunch of hired goons. And if they die, no one's going to know the difference. Tomorrow they'll be forgotten. But rather, in a slow progression, in a very obvious way for the public to see, have my adversaries suffer a decline. So Rashi explains, Altargem, she'ein zu nekama hanikaret. This is not an obvious vengeance. It won't look so clear that this is God avenging David. Rather, the dead all get forgotten eventually. Rather, cause them to decline in their power and their money. That they should be poor. Because that is the kind of thing that is remembered for a long time. Now let's apply this to what Augustine is saying about the Jews. Don't let all the Jews die in the year 410. Rather, let the Jews stick around. But as what? As aniim, as impoverished, not very strong, but let them be an underclass for the foreseeable future, and as a proof of the truths of Christianity.
In 410, was there a movement afoot to kill the Jews?
So not all over the empire, and certainly not with the approval of the government. But we shall see there were localized massacres in the Byzantine Empire and in the Western Empire in the 5th century. Things got a little rough and tumble. We'll talk about that shortly.
Wasn't there a dynamic that fostered this? I mean, you're going to go and hit upon something.
Yeah.
You got to have some sort of reason or theological...
Okay, so the answer is sometimes there'll be a proximate cause, which was some Jewish offense against Christian sensibilities. And other times it'll just be like a wild and rabid, crazy theologian who... In the cause of zealous fundamentalism, doesn't need an excuse. Just does it. We'll see. There's both of those. Now, the last point of Augustine's doctrine of witnesses, hand in hand with Jewish survival, the refutation of Judaism contributes directly to the vindication of Christianity. So, yes, we need Jews to survive, but the refutation of Judaism is not just about saying about us being happy that they lost. Rather, their defeat is our victory. That's a zero-sum game. One guy's loss is another guy's win. Okay, now Augustine broke from the Manichaeans, who, as I said, didn't like the Old Testament. And instead, he adopted a more moderate approach to Jews and Judaism, which includes this doctrine of witness, which allows for Jewish survival. Jews are branded with the mark of Cain. Cain, okay? Vayasem Hashem l'Cain ot, l'boti akot oto kol motzo'o. Genesis chapter 4. So the mark of Cain is an ambiguous thing. Is it a good thing for Cain or a bad thing for Cain?
It was a good thing originally. They would know who he is.
Okay, good. So it offers an element of protection so he doesn't get killed. However, it also identifies him as a fratricide. So in applying this to the Jews, it's a mark of protection. The doctrine of witness means they shouldn't die. You don't kill them, but they're identified, and they're identified as having killed Jesus, as a fratricide, killing a fellow Jew. Notice I don't say deicide. I say fratricide, Jew killing Jew. Now, an important Jew in their eyes, but along the lines of Cain and Hevel. Also, slay them not offers as an offer of a prayer for protection. David speaking about Saul's men. But it also assumes that they're reprehensible, meaning they don't die now, but they're disgusting, they're terrible. So the same thing with the Jew. They're terrible, but they shouldn't die now. Okay. Now, Augustine believed that Jews would eventually see the light and accept Christianity. This is where he differs from Eusebius. Eusebius didn't really care at all about what happened to the Jews at the end of time. He just was using Jewish history as a tool to advance a theological agenda. But Augustine says, yeah, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, and probably not even 100 years from now. But at some point, la'achris yamim, the Jews will convert to Christianity. For Augustine, the empirical argument of Christian success was overwhelming, overwhelming. He just couldn't fathom how anyone would see otherwise. he praised early Israel, but faulted the Jews for two things. Number one, from deviating from the original religious insights of Israel. And secondly, for failing to understand the truly spiritual character of religious life. In this regard, he repeats what Paul said, that the Jews are carnal Israel, physical Israel, not spiritual Israel. And that it's somehow carnal Israel is inferior to spiritual Israel. He also makes the point that the Jews are the descendants of Ishmael and the church are the descendants of Yitzchak. Okay, and then Varav Yavod Sa'ir, that the older one shall serve the younger one, that the older religion serves the younger religion. He says the rejection of Saul for David and the rejection of Eli for Shmuel prefigures the rejection of biological Israel in favor of spiritual Israel, with Jesus representing the priest king. So Shmuel, the religious leader, David, the political leader, are replacements for the failed leadership of Eli and Shaul. So the Jews are Eli and Shaul. The church is Samuel and David. And Jesus represents the priest king. Now, the last thing I want to say about Augustine before I go to the next topic of the Theodosian Code is that it is often claimed that Augustine said the Jews should survive, but not thrive. Survive, but not thrive. Some of you, I'm sure, read Constantine's Sword by James Carroll. In that book, which is a popular book and not really the most scholarly of books, he quotes this notion of survive but not thrive. All the Augustine scholars say, he never said such a thing. Yes, Psalm 59, verse 12, if you look in the Rashi, the idea of they should be poor, but Augustine never said that. All he said was the Jews will survive and there'll be a religious minority. But he never said that they can't be materially successful. He just said, well, the reality is that they've been replaced and the Christian success and the church's success is such an overwhelming fact that nobody could deny it. Okay, now let's move away from the realm of theologians and into the realm of the practical, the law, because the law is, it's important in two ways. Number one, in theory, you're supposed to live according to the law. The law of the land is the law, Dina de Malchus Adina. But also, the way the law was written in the late Roman Empire, both in the Byzantine East and in the Roman West, it took into account past incidents. So the legislator explains why he's writing the law, meaning a reaction to a specific event. Well, because the following happened, I'm now declaring the following law. So for the study of history, this is a boon. We don't just get the final product, we get like the work product. Well, Jews were Roman citizens, but legislation was working against them in the 5th and 6th centuries. Once a right was lost, it was never permanently regained. The Theodosian Code of the year 438 represented the maximum of Jewish rights. And as time went on, matters would eventually reach the medieval ghetto. So we're having a descending slope of Jewish rights, that in the pagan Rome, Jews had significant amount of rights. Early Christian Rome, a nice amount, protected in various ways, but it's a steep decline. Now, lawlessness and ecclesiastical enthusiasm could negate whatever rights did exist within the law, meaning it's one thing that on the books Jews are protected in X, Y, or Z fashion, but in a wild, wild west scenario where the law is a dead letter, where the local sheriff doesn't give a damn, so it doesn't matter that the law protects the Jew. The local sheriff is the law of the land, and he's going to do whatever he wants. Or ecclesiastical enthusiasm. Some local bishop gets a bug up him that I got to persecute the Jews. I got to kill some Jews. I got to destroy a synagogue. So he'll do it. Does the law allow it? No. Who's stopping him? Maybe nobody. Okay.
Are there any writings by Amoraim where somewhat later period Jewish scholars who react or reflect on all of this?
Yeah, so the Agadita, the literature of Eretz Yisrael in the Midrash Agadah will reflect these conditions, that in 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th century Eretz Yisrael, life is challenging because of Christian hostility.
Are they able to express themselves?
Not always so clearly or freely because of concern for aggravating some higher, you know, government official or church official who then can do terrible things. But it's clear from the Midrash Haggadah, whether it's the Rabbah, the Tanchuma, okay, that life is not pleasant because the church is out to get us. Okay, so now Honorius, who was the emperor after Theodosian I, needed money. So what did he do? He imposed curial service on the Jews, meaning you have to serve as a tax collector for various purposes, and the money comes out of your pocket if you fail to collect. In 399, he took all the money the Jews sent to Jerusalem and called the patriarch the ravager of the Jews. So this is an interesting concept, that the money from Machatzit HaShekel was still being collected years and years later, but instead of going to the Beis HaMikdash, was going to the Beit HaNasi, the House of Gamliel, which was a strong, powerful institution and recognized by the Roman government up until it was no longer recognized in the year 425, in the days of Gamliel VI. But certainly from the days of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Judah the Patriarch, in the year 200, for the next 200 years, this is a powerhouse institution. This is the leadership of the Jewish people in Eretz Israel and beyond. So money is sent that way. Well, it's always tempting to steal money, especially when money is crossing international frontiers or from one province to another. And he would argue that he was doing the Jews of Italy a favor. Why should you send your money to some big shot rabbi in Israel? Keep your money here. You know, why donate to a synagogue five towns away? What do you have to do with them? And he says, as a matter of Italian patriotism, Roman patriotism, what are you doing sending financial resources to a distant land that's not us, not our people? Okay. Now, in the early 5th century, Jews were expelled from the civil service and from the army. Some were allowed to remain until retirement at a degraded rank. But even this was seen as a special concession, never to be repeated. What 20th century parallel exists to that? Sure. Correct. What about the Germans?
They have soldiers who are paying, still Jewish soldiers paying benefits all the way.
Correct. Okay, so the answer is that in 1933, Jews were expelled from the civil service, one of the earliest acts of Nazi oppression of the Jews, not just from the military, of course, but even from the civilian civil service. But some exceptions were made for Jewish heroes of the German army from World War I, that they received a preferential treatment as late as 1939. And even then, even that was done away with. Okay, so because Honorius and Arcadius, his Eastern counterpart, were ruling at a time of distress, Jews who converted to Christianity to avoid paying debts were forced to pay the debts nonetheless. It used to be you could try to, you know, change religions to save a buck. And at times, the church was happy to accept you. Yes, under very dubious circumstances, but they were going to accept you. But when times of, you know, a fiscal crisis, that's a scam. We're not going to let you pull that one. Pay it anyway. Okay? And sometimes they were even allowed to return to Judaism, which is saying something, that a person who took baptism could go back to Judaism. Well, yes, because it was a fraudulent baptism. Jews were seen as a social threat to Christians in Africa, as seen as significant Judaizing tendencies. The church in Africa had flavor of Judaism. Pesach, Shabbos, certain things that we do, we're still rubbing off on them. Now, North Africa is a pretty far out of the way place when it comes to the church, so it's not surprising the Jews could still contribute to the shaping of that church. But Christians were a physical threat to Jews, and Honorius had to issue edicts respecting the sanctity of the Jewish Sabbath and the physical security of synagogues, lest they be burned down or ripped down by an angry mob. Valentin III repeated the law that Jews could not hold public office. Why? What was the logic of saying Jews cannot hold public office? Well, Christians should not serve such persons, lest by their office they find ways to corrupt the Christian faith. Meaning a boss over an employee has a lot of power, and a lot of power to force you to violate your religious scruples. Just think of the boss who doesn't get off on Shmini Atzeres. You know, a boss can help you violate your religious scruples any way he wants. Okay. Well, Theodoric the Ostrogoth, who ruled in 493, said the following: as to the Jews, let the privileges they enjoy be preserved, and let them preserve their own judges. So an Ostrogoth, nominally a Christian, said, yeah, the Jews have rights, and we're going to preserve them. When a synagogue was destroyed in Ravenna and in Rome, Theodoric required the Romans of Ravenna to rebuild the synagogue with their own money, and if they couldn't pay, they would be flogged. But he wouldn't go beyond the law and did not allow the expansion of existing synagogues. So you can't build a new one, you can't expand an old one, but if the Goyim, if the Christians destroy one, they got to pay for it and rebuild it. Yes, yes, in Ravenna, but not in Rome. In Rome, it was a whole convoluted story. In the end, it wasn't rebuilt. Okay. Now, Gregory the Great, the Pope from 590 to 604, who's not only the Pope, but is also the head of state of the papal lands, was very interested in having Jews convert to Catholicism. He offered financial incentives, such as reduced rent on papal estates, which is a big deal because the Pope owned a lot of land and rented it out to a lot of commoners, including Jews. Well, reduced rent is a reason to convert. Also, free baptismal robes. That sounds like, 1995, no money down. It sounds like a huckster on a home shopping network, but whatever. Free baptismal robe and erasure of debts. He understood that this would yield insincere converts, but then at least the children would be raised with a Christian education. Interesting idea. As I know, it's a bogus conversion, but once they convert, the kid goes not to the cheder, but to the Catholic school, so they'll be sincere in their religiosity. The Bishop of Naples interfered in the internal Jewish affairs in an attempt to foster conversions. Gregory told him not to do that. It was illegal. Better to try kindness, he suggested. A major complication was the slave trade. Gregory wanted to rule that any Christian bought by a Jew automatically goes free. And to a large extent, that was true. However, there was a leniency. If a slave was discovered to have been a Christian after you bought him, then the Jewish master had 40 days to sell it to a Christian. So, yes, Jews owned slaves, and it was possible the Jews would end up owning a Christian slave, but they had to relinquish that slave, but they were given some window of opportunity to do so at the cost that they paid. Now, it was a riotous and lawless era. The burning of a synagogue by a mob is a direct outcome of the intellectual gymnastics of the learned, who themselves would rarely have dreamed of committing such violence. Basically, you have these egghead ivory tower professor Christian types, theologians, who are writing with their kulmus on their parchment in some abbey or some monastery, saying that the Jews are the devil, all sorts of horrible things, but they themselves would never get their hands dirty. But if you read their material, or their material is read to a wild and riled up mob, that mob will burn down a building or kill people. Okay. So Gregory the Great could turn from the dictation of one of his many, many flowery denunciations of the Jews for their diabolical perversity and detestable characteristics to deal with correspondence and write to a bishop who has only been carrying out these denunciations to the logical conclusion and remind him that it is by love and charity alone that we can hope to win over the Jews. So here Gregory writes all sorts of invective against the Jews on the one hand, but then when he has to respond to a bishop who burned down a shul, tells him, no, little bishop of you can't burn down the shul. You have to treat him with love and charity. So he's speaking out of two sides of his mouth. The theoretical side is vicious. The practical side says, well, you really can't do that. And you guys did it, so you better better stop. Okay. And then he said, even they who don't wish to be converted must be treated with justice and allowed undisturbed use of the rights that the law allows them. So the law is the law passed by the government, by the Roman emperors, and the various codes that are in force. The church can't write its own laws. It can write consular laws that affect religious issues, but it doesn't make the law of the land. The Din of the Malchus says by the emperors, and you can't break these rules. So as much as we might hate the Jews or think ill of them, we have to restrain our behavior. Enough. The next pope, Honorius, allowed baptized Jews to return to Judaism, a real chesed, okay, because most popes did not. Pope Adrian, or Adrianus, in 772, forbade the observance of Easter on the same day as Passover, something which has been around since the Council of Nicaea. But the fact that he had to repeat it means there were some Christians observing Easter on the day of Passover. Why? Because Judaizing and Jewish influence over the church is still a factor even in the 8th century. So Jesus has been dead and rolling over in his grave a long, long time. Okay? And yet the Jews are still influencing the church. He forbade the acceptance of... Yeah, yeah. Sure.
By Jews
No, not Jews. The Pope's writing. So the acceptance of any gift from the Jews on their feasts is forbidden. So again, we see what? The Jews make shalach manis and give it to a goy. The Jew makes a Pesach Seder and makes extra brisket and gives it to the goy neighbor. Or he invites him into the sukkah. That cross-cultural fertilization was happening, and the Pope doesn't like it and says you can't have from the Jews' feast on their yontif.
But didn't you mention the other week that we also have situations where you should not invite a non-Jew to a Seder?
Oh, yes. I spent a whole session on that 2 years ago, that inviting a non-Jew to a Seder is a big no-no.
So it should be a mutual agreement of not doing it.
Okay, but the Jews are not always being led by halachic decisors and following the minutiae of Talmudic law. They're just people, and they have holidays, and the neighbor is a nice guy, so they offer an invitation.
In the holidays, you do have some Jews coming to the Seder, who are coming to houses that are somewhat legitimately Jewish, you know.
That's true.
And so, you know, what do you make of that?
It happens. Whether it should happen is another story. There are all sorts of halachic and meta-halachic and philosophical and historical reasons to object, but it does happen. Now, Jews cannot give evidence against the Catholic clergy, and Gentiles can't rest on the Sabbath. On this, there's universal agreement. Okay? Goy sheshavas chayav misa. The Talmud says if a goy observes Shabbos, he's liable for the death penalty. Now, it's not realistically to kill him, but it's a Talmudic statement. And here the Pope is saying, goy sheshavas chayav misa.
When did Sunday become a...
The Lord's Day in the first century. Okay.
So now, there shouldn't be any conflict.
There shouldn't be, and yet...
But you're saying in practice.
In practice it was. So we see that social intercourse between Christians and Jews continues until very late in the game. Now, the popes followed the Theodosian Code and earlier councils. They did not indulge in spasmodic cruelties and sudden expulsions. Basically, the popes were reliable not to all of a sudden try to stamp out Jewish life and have them murdered or expelled from the country, oppressed viciously. No, that was not the papal way in the first 8 centuries. It may have been the way of some of the more feisty bishops, and it may have been the way of the masses and some of the emperors who didn't like Jews, but not the popes. They didn't control the national clergy, so the lower-ranking ecclesiastics would do whatever they wanted, and papal control was only nominal at this point. Now the Catholic Church is like a monolith, but in the old days it wasn't. So where the popes personally held sway, while they showed the Jews no special favor, they protected the rights as required by law. So at least to that regard, we have to be grateful to a handful of halfway decent popes. Now let's go to the Byzantine Empire. We go from the west to the east. The west to the east. So during Arcadius's reign, which is around 400, nasty preachers led attacks on the character and dignity of the Jewish patriarch, the Nasi. Despite his very high rank and official nobility, he was subject to all sorts of insult by the ecclesiastics of Eretz Yisrael. And physical assault, no, but insult, yes. And eventually this leads to the demise of the patriarchate. No more building of synagogues after the year 415. Law was enacted on the books, including in Eretz Yisrael. Theodosius II wrote about Purim in the 420s. And the unacceptably wild behavior the Jews showed on Purim. So if you recall, a couple of years ago, I wrote an article about this, and I think I spoke about this here with Young Israel, about how Purim was seen by the Gentiles as a problematic holiday. Of all the books of the Hebrew Bible, what's the most Jewish book as far as the church was concerned? Esther. Why? Yehudim. Not Yisrael, not B'nai Yisrael, Yehudim, Jew. And it's all about, in the end, the Jews killing the Gentiles. It's aggressive. It's not a turn the other cheek kind of story. The ending is very aggressively pro-Jewish, and they don't like it. And there are people who are mityahadim, Judaizing, becoming Jews, pagans who become Jews, in chapter 9. That's exactly what the church doesn't want. Okay, well, what do the Jews do to celebrate Purim? What kind of rowdy behavior do Jews have on Purim?
And that's correct.
What's a little bit more violent? Burning Haman in effigy. So the burning of Haman in effigy was a standard practice in the old days. Now all we have left is a gragger, where we smack the name of Haman on a gragger or on a stone, the Rama says. But the burning of Haman in effigy was a common practice. Well, who do they think the Haman really is? Jesus. Okay? So Theodosius wrote, if they continue to commit such unlawful acts, they would lose what had so far been lawful privileges. Yeah. So what Theodosius is saying is, you better behave yourselves, Jews. Don't let Purim get out of hand. Because if it does, the rights you currently enjoy, you will no longer enjoy. An episode in 418, about a decade later, at Inmistar in Syria, in which a Christian boy was crucified by a drunken Purim mob of Jews. Now, we don't know for sure, but James Parks, the author of Conflict of the Church and the Synagogue, who's an Anglican priest, but a philo-Semite and a great defender of the Jews and a strong opponent of anti-Semitism, says he thinks that episode really did happen because there's no record of the church claiming that miracles happen to the body. That if it was false, it would be shrouded in sorts of the miraculous. The fact that there's no miraculous leads him to believe it really happened. So if it did, what occurred? You know, kids got a little too drunk on Purim, a couple of too many schnapps, and they killed a kid. All right. Now, an episode in Alexandria in the 420s happened a few years later. First, the Jews killed a bunch of Christians, and then the Christians killed a bunch of Jews. This led to the degradation of Rabban Gamliel VI in 425. But Gamliel had that he lost his title as the ethnarch of the Jews, that the Nasi was no longer a recognized a noble position in the Roman Empire. No. He wasn't killed, no. But Gamliel had been doing things that offended the Byzantine authorities. Number one, he was building new synagogues against the rules. Number two, he was judging cases involving Christians against the rules. And number three, he was circumcising slaves. Why? Because the Torah says, what do you do to your Eved Kanani? Give him a bris milah. Except that it had been illegal for 300 years in Rome to do that. Okay. Now, mob violence. Maybe their counterparty was a Jew, and the Jew schlepped them to the Nasi, and the Nasi issued a ruling. So mob violence was worse than official acts. In 418, the emperor warned both sides after a widespread burning of synagogues and attacks on individual Jews. He reminded the populace that there are law courts in which Jews who commit crimes will be punished. And quote, just as we make provision for the benefit of the Jews, so must we also consider that a warning should be addressed to the Jews that they must not presume upon their security to commit outrages against the Christian faith. So basically, yeah, don't commit acts of revenge violence against the Jews. There are law courts. Take it to the law court. But the Jew better realize that he's a minority and better simmer down and not cause any offense to the Christian faith. A sinister figure, Bar Sauma, appeared in Eretz Yisrael in the year 423 with 40 fellow monks. And for 3 years, he went unchecked, destroying synagogues all over Eretz Yisrael. Ultimately, the emperor stepped in and said that no synagogue could be pulled down, and if it had been confiscated, it had to be returned. But no new buildings could be built, and no expansion of existing ones. The law had no effect. 2 months later, the Jews were still desperately begging the emperor for more protection of the synagogues. It's like in America today. You ask for that $75,000 grant from the federal government for Homeland Security, they keep you waiting. My shul still didn't get it, okay? We need security, but they don't give the money. So, my synagogue, yeah. We didn't get it. You got it here? Wouldn't we got it? Yeah.
Who was the governing body that made the denial?
I'm not sure. I'll let you know. No, federal. Yeah. Okay, so now there's a key point here made by James Parks. Quote, laws which indulge in futile abuse of those whom they are meant to protect are not likely to be successful. That's a mouthful. What he really means to say is this. All these government rules that say you can't burn down a shul, don't burn down a shul, don't burn down a, don't bother to the Jews. In the very same sentence says, don't burn down the house of worship of those terrible Jews. Okay? Don't molest on the street those Christ-killing Jews. You know, if you throw in some invective in the line that says don't bother them, then the line that says don't bother them is totally negated and is not going to help. Go to Shelfen. Okay. In 442, Bar Suama came back to Eretz Israel, and he was upset by permission granted by the emperor to allow Jews to go to the Kotel on Tisha B'Av to mourn the Beis HaMikdash. So because he was so bothered to hit that the Jews could go to the Kotel on Tisha B'Av, he committed a general massacre of the Jews of Yerushalayim. Oive. So that's an example of, you know, real violence. In the
Where was the church?
The official church is not involved. This is just some monk who's gone crazy. In the 5th century, Jews had it better than heretics. How so? There was no JDL back then. So Jews had it better than heretics. How so? Because heretics were not allowed to have clergy. At least the Jews could have rabbis. But those rabbis were not exempted by virtue of their profession from the curial service, meaning there was no free parking sticker for the rabbi, you know, to park in the handicap spot or whatever. The prerogatives of the office were given to the priest, were not given to the rabbis. Okay, now we go to the Justinian Code. Justinian was the emperor from 527 to 565, and his code is the big one. He was the emperor.
Secular.
Yeah. So the laws were written over a span of time and were codified and collated under his auspices. Those rules which were written in the early 400s, which were designed to protect Jews, were omitted. So we see where this is headed. The protections are omitted. The formal statement recognizing the legality of Judaism, which had been issued by Theodosius the Great, was also omitted. Now what does that mean? That Judaism is no longer officially a lawful religion. And the Jews are not a lawfully recognized nation. So anything could happen to them. Without that kind of basic protection, who knows where this will lead?
Why can't you just say that it's just only else?
That's a very modern notion. Okay. Now, all immunities for synagogue officials were omitted. Justinian was more severe than his predecessors with regard to Jewish economic status and slaveholding. If a heretical slave wanted to convert to Catholicism, he was to be freed immediately. So listen, previously, if the Jew owned a Christian slave, then what? Goes free. Okay? If it turned out that he was Christian, but you didn't know, you have 40 days to sell him. What if he was a heretic, meaning not a correct believing, like not an Orthodox or Catholic Christian, but was some heretical sect? You could own him. But if he wants now to become a Catholic, he automatically gets his freedom. So what if he has any seichel? What does he do? I want to be a Catholic. And lo and behold, he's free. Now, what about the Jew? Can the Jew also have a little seichel and say, I'll also become Catholic and I'll keep you as my slave. I'll follow you to the baptismal font. Does that work? No, it doesn't work. Doesn't work. Okay. Now,
well, what's supposed to work in that?
Nothing. Guy goes free. Now, just,
are they on the same level as pagans?
Or who? Worse? Who, heretics?
The Jews.
The Jews are the same, basically, as pagans. But With certain protections for Judaism, not necessarily codified into the law, that the pagans didn't have. The pagans are a false belief that could be stamped out absolutely, whereas Judaism was not going to be stamped out absolutely. Justinian restricted the right of Jews to acquire property by forbidding them to lease land owned by the church or by a religious order. Now, the church owns a lot of land. Ad hayom hazeh, the church owns a lot of land. Okay, so if you can't lease from them, there's not much you can do. He further curtailed Jews to give evidence in court. No testimony could be given by a Jew if either party was a Catholic. Jews could only give evidence in cases involving Jews or heretics. By dropping formal recognition of the right of Jews to exist, the sovereign in any locale could choose to tolerate or not tolerate Jews as he wished. This is opening the door to more severe persecution. A convert to Judaism was punished with exile and confiscation of all their property. Jewish polygamy was forbidden, and intermarriage with a Christian was forbidden. It was permitted only if the Jew converted to Christianity. Okay. The most surprising rule in the Justinian Code was novella number 146. And we have 15 minutes left, and I want to spend our time on novella 146. What was it? Well, it regulated Jewish belief and liturgical services. This was a radical change.
What comes from
in the whole Roman Empire, but especially the Eastern Empire?
Eastern Empire?
Yes.
it ultimately broke away.
Well, it had already broken away. In 395, it's broken between East and West. The Justinian Code is supposed to apply everywhere, but is more definitively applied in the East.
Why?
Because the West was hard to control. It was breaking up into different pieces.
Just did not include it.
It nominally does, but remember, he's ruling out of Constantinople, Byzantium, East. So the traditional Christian Roman approach was to say that the Jews were wrong in how they believed and how they observed their faith, but exactly how they conduct themselves was of little concern to the Christian state. It was a subject for internal Jewish jurisdiction, meaning Judaism is a false religion. All right, so the Jews believe in it, they do things, let the rabbis figure it out. We don't care what they do. We just know it's wrong. So we're not going to regulate how many Yekum Perkins they're going to say. But now they are. Now they are. So there was a conflict in the synagogue about what language to use for Torah reading. Some wanted a vernacular reading, while others wanted to retain the original Hebrew. Justinian ruled that Torah had to be read in Greek, Latin, or a locally understood vernacular. And he forbade the explanation or the drasha. Remember, one of the key points of the synagogue was not just the reading of the original text of the Hebrew Bible. It was the Targum, the translation into Aramaic, and the drasha. And the drasha results in what literature that we have? The Medrash. The Medrash Agada is all based upon drashot of Eretz Israel. So he orders excommunication to those who deny that angels were part of creation, or who deny the resurrection or the final judgment. Those who violate the liturgical rules are to be beaten and exiled. So this is very bizarre. I mean, it was crazy. It created heretical categories in already heretical beliefs. It's like an Orthodox rabbi saying that we're going to look at the Reform responsa literature and say, well, this is even more wrong than that. It's peculiar that you take a religion you say is incorrect and you parse it further for this is even more incorrect, this is acceptable, this is not acceptable. It also shows something very interesting. That was not the intention here. I'll explain to you what the intention was. So first, before I get to that,
let's say the logic that we believe that God did create all these problems,
there's
got to be a reason. So the reason has to be that the Jews were either getting too friendly with the Christians or had it too easy an out.
That's all I could say. So now, what it shows, the fact that Justinian is breathing fire against Jews who don't believe in angels, who don't believe in the resurrection, don't believe in the final judgment, it tells you something very important, that Sadducean beliefs were still around in the 6th century. Why am I all excited about this? Sadducean. I'm excited about this because there's a subtopic within the study of Jewish history that tries to connect the Tzedokim, the Sadducees of Second Temple fame, and the Karaites of medieval times, and for that matter, the Sabbateans of later times. Well, is there really a connection between the Tzedokim who were around in the first century BCE and first century CE, and the Karaim of 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century Middle East? It doesn't seem like there's any connection. And yet here, what do we see? That in Eretz Yisrael, or in the Eastern Roman Empire, there are Jews who don't accept Pharisaic rabbinic beliefs on significant issues like Tchias HaMeisim, Yom HaDin, you know, the final Yom HaDin HaGadol, Malachim, and maybe a host of other issues. Now, the church, in this respect, agrees with the Pharisees, which is not surprising. Why? Because Jesus was supposedly a Pharisee, and the Sadducees are the other camp. But yet it's still around.
Jesus being assumed to be, say,
a Pharisee.
Yeah. Where's the proof that they have that so?
Well, I know you're convinced he never lived, right? And he might not have.
They found tuition.
Okay, so now that's good. So why did Justinian do this? So why did he forbid the drasha, the Dvar Torah, why did he insist upon the translation into the vernacular? Very important points coming up. So he embodied in legislation the complaint frequently made by Jerome and others that Jewish teachers consciously and deliberately gave teachings which falsified the meaning of the original text and therefore prevented the congregation, which could not understand Hebrew, from seeing the continual allusions to the coming of Jesus Messiah and the passing of the promises to the church. Basically, what it means is this. The church believes that if you read the Pashut Pshat of Tanakh, you'll become a Christian, because you'll see that all the prophecies point in the direction of Christian truth. So why are the Jews not coming to that conclusion? Because they don't understand Hebrew. They don't know how to read the Bible. What are they getting? They're getting their rabbis who are twisting and twisting and twisting with the homiletics to give a rabbinical interpretation of Torah, which steers clear of Christological implications. So what's the solution? Abolish the rabbi's drasha, abolish the Hebrew reading of the Bible, force them to read it in the translation. Now they'll see the pashut pshat and they'll become goyim. Okay. Now,
later on,
yeah,
the Catholic Church would send priests
into the synagogues.
Did that happen now?
Not just yet. It'll happen soon, though. So, in the view of the Church, Christological interpretations of Scripture jump off the page, and Jews need to have an unrestricted view of the text. But the question is, which translation should you use? And there were two that were given official sanction, the Septuagint and Aquila. Why? Because the Targum Shivim, at least for certain later books of the Bible, had been tinkered with. It was originally written by devout Jews, by loyal Jews, but it had been tinkered with over time to reflect a Christian perspective. And Aquila, because it was very literal, and the Christians thought that that would benefit them. The law was not anti-Semitic in the view of James Parks. James Parks, admittedly an Anglican priest, says this is not an anti-Semitic law. It was grandmotherly. What does he mean? He means it wasn't intended to hurt anyone. It wasn't intended to harm someone's religious convictions. It was intended to improve the situation that the Jews should see the light on their own without the galach, without the priest going into the shul and pounding the table and yelling at them. The Jews themselves would come to the right, so-called right conclusions. Okay? It was a serious attempt to make Jews convert on their own. Now, Protestants in the 16th and 17th centuries would make similar comments about how the Catholic Church was forbidding their own constituents from seeing an unobstructed view of the Bible. Do Catholics read the Bible? No. They read select passages that are highlighted in a yellow marker. If you ever read a Catholic Bible, a couple of passages here and there they read. They don't read it cover to cover. The Protestants prefer reading cover to cover. Now, also, even before Martin Luther, but even before Martin Luther, there were certain figures who believed that the layman had not been given access to the scriptures in the vernacular, and as a result, his religiosity suffered. Who are these two that I'm referring to? Bonus points if you know this answer. John Wycliffe in England, what happened to him? He was killed and his bones were burnt and his ashes were thrown into the Thames River. And Jan Hus, who was burned at the stake. He translated the Bible into the Bohemian, to the Czech languages. Okay, so the church itself had problems later on of no direct access and wanting to have translations. Okay, as persecution of the Jews in the Byzantine Empire became more intense, Jews naturally looked to Persia for succor. The war between the Persians and the Byzantines lasted on and off from the early 5th century until well into the 7th century. It's a 200 years war. Jews from the Galilee helped the Persian army take Jerusalem in 614. It is claimed that the Jews destroyed churches and massacred Christians. It's probably true, but we don't know for sure. When Heraclius took over Jerusalem in 629, the Christians got their revenge on the Jews and killed many. When the Muslims conquered Eretz Yisrael 9 years after that, in 638, the Jews sided with the Muslims and avenged the death inflicted by Heraclius. So basically, there were three takeovers of Yerushalayim in the span of a quarter century. 614 to 617, the Persians defeat the Christians. 629, the Christians defeat the Persians, and 638, the Muslims defeat the Christians. The Jews always side with the non-Christians. Okay. There were forced baptisms all throughout the 8th century. Pope Leo ruled that either parent could decide that the child be brought up as a Christian. So if there's a machlokas in the house, the mother becomes a Christian, but not the father, or vice versa. The one parent who converts to is a mishumid can decide the religious fate of the child. Yet as late as the 8th century, it was still necessary to legislate against Judaizing and fraternizing. The Council of Trullo ruled the clergy will not be friendly to the Jews. So even the Galachim were friendly with Jews. Don't eat unleavened bread with Jews on Passover. So again, don't go to their Seder, or don't go to the lunch on Yontif with having matzah. Don't accept their hospitality. Don't visit them when they are sick. So no biker cholim by a Christian to a Jew. Don't receive medicine from them, which is an interesting point because Jews were doctors. Don't visit the baths with them. So in other words, don't go to the Schwitz with them.
How effective were these laws if they had to go ahead and not very effective.
They were not very effective. They had to be repeatedly promulgated. If they're promulgated time and time again over many centuries, mistama, they're not being abided by carefully. So, and some worldly minded clerics even went into money lending operations with Jews. Can you believe that? A galach going into ribbis with a Jew. Okay. Yeah.
That's a very big sin,
but they were doing it. So there is not yet, in the time we're discussing, already into the 8th century, an absolute gulf between Christians and Jews. There is still some mutual respect and genuine friendship among ordinary folks. The Jews are not this devilish character that is so odd and different, you know, than everyone else. But next week, we're going to jump ahead. I'm going to skip over a couple of centuries and we're going to get towards the Crusader period. And now we're going to start talking about how the Jew really is the total other. And the days of mutual respect are gone. And so the flavor of anti-Semitism will be much more sinister and intense, with much worse consequences for the lives of Jews. Okay, so we'll stop here and see you all next week.